Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
I'll get to some of your messages in a couple of minutes' time. But did you know that according to new research, mandatory reporting of allegations of abuse can contribute to secondary trauma in survivors? To find out what's behind that and underpinning that particular contention, the Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and Senior Lecturer at the School of Law in UCC is Dr. Conor O'Mahony, who's been with us previously. Good morning again, Conor, and thank you for joining us. The research is entitled Who Helps the Helpers? And it's what's called vicarious traumatization in psychologists, and their experience as mandated reporters is due to be published in the near future. Would you explain to me first what is vicarious traumatization?
So vicarious traumatization would be where one person experiences trauma as a result of being closely exposed to the trauma of another person. So in this context, it's that a person who has experienced sexual abuse seeks support by way of therapeutic intervention from a therapist or counsellor. And so obviously the person who has experienced sexual abuse is traumatised very much as a result and finds the process of dealing with that to be very traumatic. But then the person who is providing treatment and support to them can in turn be traumatised by the difficulty of trying to work through that process with them. So in essence, the research is about the fact that as things are currently structured, the way the law impacts on this therapeutic process, which we'll discuss in a moment, and can have the effect of traumatising both the person seeking support and the person trying to provide it.
Now, the study, as I understand it from reports, it's not published yet, which surveyed the views of psychologists working for the HSE, found what it called negative unintended consequences of mandatory reporting. Now, that's a legal requirement, I believe, from around 2017. And the author of the study is quoted as saying the extent and pervasiveness of these issues were surprising. Mandatory reporting then, December 2017, and it has contributed to a rise in numbers of referrals linked to suspected abuse to the Child and Family Agency. Well, I suppose much was made at the time that so much had gone under the radar over decades and decades in regards to this, of maybe people not necessarily turning a blind eye, but maybe not wanting to get involved any further. Was not the purpose of mandatory reporting the inevitable result would be a rise in referrals anyway, Conor?
Well, yes, I mean, that would have been the intention of it, to make sure that cases where referrals should happen, that they would happen. But what we have here is a kind of an unintended consequence of the interaction between the mandatory reporting laws and a separate body of laws that maybe wasn't anticipated when mandatory reporting was introduced. So just to walk you through it as simply as I can, the position is now that if an adult goes to a counsellor seeking support in respect of having been sexually abused as a child, and we know from research that the majority of children who are sexually abused don't disclose this as children, they often wait until they're adults. So you're people who are taking a very big step, dealing with an awful lot of unresolved trauma, and perhaps have no desire to engage with any form of formal investigation by the Gardaí or by TUSLA. They just want therapy, basically. So they go to a therapist, they want to seek confidential therapeutic support. But the mandatory reporting laws now oblige the therapist in that situation, if there's a disclosure made about child sexual abuse, to notify TUSLA about that, because there's a risk, of course, that the abuser or the alleged abuser may still be at large in the community and may still pose a risk to other children. Now, there's a good reason for that law, obviously, so that in itself isn't a problem. But the difficulty is how that then interacts with the law governing how TUSLA investigates these allegations of what are called retrospective child sexual abuse involving, you know, people who are now adults but were abused as children. And in short, once that mandated report is made to TUSLA, the manner in which TUSLA currently handle those allegations is that they will immediately notify the person who has been the subject of the allegation that an allegation has been made against them. And that can then trigger a whole investigative process during which you can have a situation where the complaint is what they call stress tested to see whether it's a credible complaint or not, all of which can be very traumatic for the person who's making the disclosure of abuse and as I said, they're not something that they were seeking. They were seeking therapeutic support and can next thing find themselves in a situation where their abuser is told that they've made an allegation against them, and that can trigger a whole other process.
Isn't the delicate situation here a balance between somebody going for counselling, wanting utter and total confidentiality, and not wanting that to go any further beyond the person they're talking to? And then the psychologist's perspective, which is, I now have a legal responsibility to report this. I know you have outlined a number of possible solutions some months ago in your annual report, and we spoke on that occasion about your annual report. But before we move to that, has there not been similar scenario where, you know, the priest in confession hears particular confessions, and where does the sacredness of the priest never divulging that begin or end in regards to sharing that information because of the kind of dangers you're talking about? So we have both those going looking for help and psychologists now found in this particular bind. Is that not a fairly decent summary of it anyway?
Yeah, I mean, the people, the counsellors and psychologists and so on will tell you that they find this to be quite an ethical dilemma, because they, on the one hand, have this very clear obligation to their clients in respect of providing their clients with the best support that that client needs, and maintaining confidentiality of anything that's discussed during their sessions. So that would, you know, be the norm, I guess, in any situation like that. And now, on the other hand, you have this very clear legal obligation that if a disclosure is made to them that a child has been abused, that information it must be passed to TUSLA. It's a legal obligation.
So which view trumps the other view then, Conor, in your opinion?
Well, as a practical matter, the law would trump ethics. But the solution here, I guess, is, you know, as I said, there's a good reason for this, because, you know, if you were to amend the mandatory reporting law to say, well, you don't have to pass on that information, well, then you create a situation where potentially you have an abuser at large in the community and nothing done about that. And that, of course, could have catastrophic impacts on other children. So that, you know, watering down that obligation wouldn't necessarily be the best approach. What you have to look at then is, what can we do on the other side? What can we do to try to maintain the confidentiality of it, so that if you have somebody who doesn't wish to proceed to a formal investigation of their individual case, can we construct a process where we maintain that confidentiality in respect of avoiding a situation where that abuser received a letter saying an allegation has been made against you, potentially by this named person? Can we avoid that while at the same time still raising a flag that we have a person here who is potentially a danger and where we need to, you know, monitor this and keep an eye on this?
I'm sure you're familiar. We're all familiar where somebody comes to us and says and shares a particular thing and then tells you, I don't want anything done about it. And, you know, the person who has been abused is the ultimate victim here. And in terms of they divulging what happened to them to a counsellor or a psychologist or whatever, what they're not necessarily seeking to out the abuser. What they're, and I'm no psychologist now, I'm only just this from a lay perspective, they're seeking help. And that doesn't necessarily mean I don't want my name or my case or all out there in the greater big world where I'll be called on again to give evidence in what could be adversarial and controversial situations that will add to my problems. I'm looking for peace and resolution.
Yes, I mean, that's very much the perspective of the kind of category of people that I'm speaking about here, and that's been, you know, entirely understandable from their perspective. So that's one part of the picture. The other part of the picture is that child sex abuse as a particular crime is quite specific, in the sense that it very often isn't something that somebody does as a once-off, you know, which might be the case for other crimes. Somebody who is predisposed towards having a sexual interest in children is very likely to abuse again. And so where you have information with respect to somebody having committed an act of child sexual abuse, you do have to look at what that means for other children as well. So as I said, the question is, can we strike a balance between those two sort of competing imperatives.
Can we, in your view, I know you made recommendations in your annual report last December, how can we balance that situation then between what could be two conflicting situations? On the one hand, the victim's requirement, look, this is as far as I want to go. On the other hand, the legislative requirements, the mandatory requirements on behalf of the counsellor or psychologist. How can you balance that?
It's tricky, but there's a set of recommendations in my annual report from last year around constructing a new legal framework for this. At the moment, TUSLA are trying to do it based on an entirely unsuitable legal framework that was never really designed with this very specialist work in mind. We have an organisation called the Garda National Vetting Bureau, which people may have heard of, the concept of Garda Vetting. And the Garda Vetting Bureau, their entire function is around handling what's sometimes called soft information, where you have allegations made against people but perhaps no convictions. And that framework is somewhat underutilised at the moment. And so, in short, in my report last year, I recommended a new approach whereby you could have a situation where information like that is channeled to the Vetting Bureau, where there would be no question of the alleged abuser being notified that a certain person had made an allegation against them. So you wouldn't put any further onus on the person making the disclosure of abuse who doesn't wish to be called on in that way that you described. But at the same time, you still get that information into a place where it can be looked at in the round, it can be combined potentially with other information about other allegations, and where, if necessary, action could be taken to mitigate a risk that that person might pose to the community.
The author of the report, by the way, is a clinical psychologist, Dr. Sean Pellegrini. The report, as I say, is not published yet. It's called, Who Cares for the Carers, I think was the name of that report. Certainly it's a very delicate balancing act, and I know it's been examined by Connor and his team, by the department. There's a review of the Child Care Act 1991 happening, but certainly it's a very, very delicate balance that has to be achieved, protecting the victim, but at the same time, protecting the general community at large if there is a child abuser at large there moving under the radar. Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and Senior Lecturer at the School of Law, UCC, is Dr. Conor O'Mahony, and his annual report is online as well. We discussed it previously on the programme. Conor, thanks very much again for making time for us here on Kildare Today.
Thank you too, Tim. All the best.
Not at all. All the best to you as well. Right, up next, we're going to be hearing more about housing developments in Newbridge, concerns over that. And on the way, the co-director of Pavia Point, the Traveller and Roma Support Centre, about a report that says that traveller children are feeling unwanted in the system.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. Whitewater SC.ie.
A couple of messages then on the WhatsApp. Jim the Piper Fitzpatrick has sent us a message. Well, how nice this is. Will you wish my wife Patricia a happy 37th wedding anniversary today? She's the love of my life. Oh, Jim, I'll tell you, they'll be whispering sweet nothings in your ear this evening for such a lovely message. Darren says, when you've Martin Collins in the Pavia Point, can you ask him for his opinion of the disgraceful scenes of traveller families fighting in the Galway graveyard during a funeral? Darren, no. That's not what I'm getting him on for. And Martin Collins, in fairness, has no hand, act or matter or influence over how individuals might behave. And that would be applied to the same in the general community. Thanks for the quick response yesterday, lads. I think that was regards to the JJ Kavanagh thing. Well, we'll have more on that, queries we got from listeners yesterday regarding the JJ Kavanagh bus service at Castle Dermot and elsewhere in the county as well. Shannon O'Christine telling us that when the Pope spoke Os Gaeilge, he got the Liu Ismo, the biggest shout. People of Ireland, yeah. I think it would be fitting to have the new bank holiday on the 1st of February. St. Bridget's Day, says Sandy. Why should the men have it all to themselves? And I agree with Kira. Lionel Messi is the best soccer player ever, says Tricia. Lionel, Kira didn't say that. I said that. Don't be giving Kira a letter to take that. And already somebody is getting the Andrea Bocelli CDs that they won yesterday. Hope you enjoy those. We have more to give away today.
Now, Newbridge locals want more consultation on proposed housing developments. Yesterday, we spoke to the Cathair Loch of Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, Rob Power, about the issue. And this morning, I'm joined by Yvonne Boland, Chairperson of Newbridge Community Development. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi, Ciara. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Obviously, there's a lot to unpack here, but I'm going to start with one of Newbridge Community Development's tweets from last night. And it's a picture of a traffic sign saying, expect delays, with the caption, the story of our lives here in Newbridge. Regarding these new developments, Yvonne, just how bad will the traffic be affected, do you think, in the town?
Well, I suppose that tweet was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, and it's not referring only to traffic issues, which are obviously a key concern for a lot of people in town, and it's something that comes up so regularly when we talk to people about new houses. But I suppose if you take the broader look at it, you know, there's so much that has been delayed in relation to Newbridge in terms of the delivery of infrastructure, and even more importantly, in our view, planning initiatives. You know, so we're at the situation where we're talking specifically, or at least you were talking yesterday specifically, about two very large housing developments on the outskirts of town, and they're two of many that are either in construction at the moment, under planning application, or in pre-planning discussions. So, you know, I think it's wrong to take just a very narrow view about one specific development, or even one specific impact of that, such as traffic. The big issue, as far as we're concerned, is that you know, we're being left as almost voiceless, passive recipients of all of these planning developments. There's clearly, you know, huge impetus on the part of private commercial developers to get building and to realise the commercial potential of the sites that they own in the town. But on the other side of it, we as a community, we don't feel that we're being proactive. We don't feel that the council has been proactive about planning for Newbridge, about delivering infrastructure, but taking a long-term view. And if you don't take a long-term view on things like this, you know, you miss the boat, because yeah, decisions around zoning, they happen years previously in local area plans and county development plans and things like that. Planning applications themselves, they can be valid for 5 years. And so sometimes when you see the houses being built in front of you, it's the first you know about a development, or the first you understand about the real impact of that mm-hmm. development, and your opportunity to influence it has long gone. And that's the difficulty.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's just one issue. Some of the issues that councillors did bring up about the new developments. I know you're speaking about public consultation on proposed housing developments in general, but if we take this 204 housing development that's happening on the Ballymoney Road between Horse Racing Ireland headquarters and the Maxhall station. Some of the issues, as I said, from the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District councillors: need for more space to live and recreation areas, school places in Newbridge, GP shortages, dentists, creche place shortages, public transport access issues for the new development residents, design quality of the new dwellings, motorway noise, is it, you know, built further and away enough from the M7? I know myself, I'm in my 20s, Yvonne, I went to school in Newbridge, and there were school places issues at the time. So I can only imagine 15 years later that it's gotten worse.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's huge pressure on basic infrastructure such as obviously transport, the roads, the need for the new bridge. Until very recently, we had massive issues around our wastewater infrastructure in the town, and that actually put a hold to a lot of the development that we're seeing, you know, bubbling up now. Access to doctors, dentists. I know people are travelling out of the county to get access to dentists for their medical needs. So, you know, it's really a huge problem, and this is only going to make it worse. And this is one, as I said, one of many similar volume developments that are happening, and they're happening on the outskirts of the town. So they're creating this, you know, saucer effect, it's all referred to, a donut effect, where you're hollowing out basically the town centre, and you're developing housing density on the outskirts, which with zero services around them. I mean, they are obliged to include a creche in their planning, and usually they're obliged to deliver on that. But it's only a drop in the ocean in terms of the needs of that volume of people. You know, they need a local shop, they need a local doctor surgery, as you say, a dentist surgery, they need sports fields, playing space.
And Yvonne, if I could just interrupt you there, just very briefly, just to tie this up, because unfortunately we're going to have to go to the next guest. What exactly, and it's very complex, and I'm sure there's a lot to answer to this, but what exactly would you be calling for as chairperson of the community development of Newbridge?
Well, certainly we need to see changes to the strategic housing development programme. There's some good aspects of it, you know, but we really need to see that change to take far more account of the local input and the input from our local representatives and the council, and regard to the county development plan and the local area plan that is so important to the planning of the area. We also need to see, you know, town centre sites that are being sat on at the moment. One key site is the Kildare County Council Machinery Yard. That's a site that should be ripe for quite dense residential development in our town centre. So we need to see those sites freed up and proper use being put to them. We need to see far more proactive planning, you know, for our town. We need to see movement on our local area plan. We need to see the council talking to the community about what we need, okay, what we want, our vision for the town.
Okay, well, Chairperson of Newbridge Community Development, Yvonne Boland, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ciara.
Moving on, and a new report on the community's experience of the education system has warned that Traveller children do not feel included, wanted or safe in school, especially at second level. It's a government commissioned report out of the shadows. It remains unpublished, and it's conducted on behalf of the Department of Education as part of the National Traveller and Roma Inclusion Strategy. And joining me now is co-director of Pavey Point, the Traveller and Roma Support Centre, Martin Collins. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Owen.
What's your initial response or reaction to the headline in this report, Traveller children feeling unwanted in the education system? I suppose it's a disheartening headline, but something that you're surprised by or not?
Well, just to put this in its context, this study was conducted between November 2019 and January 2020. It's a 124-page document, 104 Traveller parents and children were interviewed, and 28 teachers and principals were also interviewed as part of the study. I am not one bit surprised. You know, if you speak to Traveller parents and Traveller children, they'll recount stories of being in a school culture of low expectations from many teachers and principals, and also a culture of racism and exclusion. So I think what the report does, it just documents really the lived experience of many young Traveller and Roma children in the schools right across this country. So not surprised, not shocked, but it is a call to action. And we're now calling on the Department of Education and the teacher unions to work with Traveller organisations and to develop a strategic response in addressing the blatant racism that does exist in our schools, both from other students and indeed from some principals, not all, it has to be said, or teachers. So, like, it is quite shocking. Like, it is, you know, young Traveller children being called pikey, being called dirty smelly, being called a knacker, other settled children not wanting to live, not wanting to sit beside them, Traveller children not being given homework and being given other easier tasks than their settled peers, which points really to a culture of low expectations of young Traveller children in the school.
You're saying, Martin, that you're calling now on the Department of Education and various different teacher unions to engage with Traveller communities and Traveller organisations to develop that strategy. What exactly would that strategy entail? What can be done here?
Well, we have to create a more welcoming and a more inclusive and a more safe school experience for all children, and obviously in this context that includes Traveller children. So we're calling for compulsory anti-racism training in the teacher training colleges. I think that's really important, so that teachers and principals are sensitised to issues around racism, discrimination and exclusion, and also to give them the skills where they can deal with racism and discrimination if they see it manifesting itself from other staff or indeed from other students. You know, they need a skill set to be able to intervene and deal with those issues. And I think the other important point here is, and there is some moves afoot in this regard, and that is that Traveller history, culture and identity needs to be in the school curriculum. And I think that would go a long way towards dealing with issues of racism and discrimination and promoting a culture of respect for cultural difference. And as I said, the NCCA, the National Council for Curriculum Assessment, is actually working on that at the moment, and we are part of that process, and we obviously welcome that. So those are just some practical initiatives that can be put in place, that can be implemented to deal with these issues. And of course, the other one is that we need to put in place affirmative action measures whereby, you know, members of our community can also become teachers. I think that's really important. We need Travellers as teachers in the schools as well, and there is a number of Travellers, I think there's 3 at the moment, who are qualified teachers, which is great, but we need to sustain that, and we need to develop that further.
The report saying that improving travellers' experience of education would be, in quotes, complex and require a multi-layered response, as you've outlined there. But one point as well that I want to put to you, Martin, is just from the article that I'm reading here on the Irish Times. Teachers and principals described, in quotes, deep frustration that they were doing their best to support traveller families, but said education was not valued in traveller culture. Many believe that traveller children wanted to leave school at 16 for girls to get married and boys to work. So what would you say to those who say that traveller children, not all traveller children, want to complete the education system?
Well, first of all, the report does acknowledge, and rightly so, that, you know, there are some traveller and Roma children who do have a very positive experience of school and are treated very fairly and treated with a lot of respect, both from their settled peers and indeed from staff, teachers and principals. So I think it's important to acknowledge that as well. But at a general level, you know, these issues do exist around discrimination and racism, and they need to be addressed. Yes, I would accept that there are some traveller parents and some traveller children who have not embraced education or has valued education in the way that it should be. And traveller organisations are working with traveller parents and working with traveller children to see the value of education at all levels, you know, from primary to post-primary and indeed to higher education. And that ambition is actually increasing all the time. For example, we now, for the first time in our history, we have 100% enrollment in primary schools. And the numbers who are transferring to secondary schools is actually increasing day by day. And indeed, the numbers progressing to higher education, universities, etc., is also increasing. So, you know, change is happening within the community, maybe not as fast as we would like, certainly as I would like, but nonetheless, we are moving in the right direction. So I would accept, absolutely, there are some challenges in relation to education for our community, and we need, you know, we need change as well.
But moving in the right direction, as you say. So on that positive note, co-director of Pave Point, the Traveller and Roma Support Centre, Martin Collins, thanks for joining us, Martin, and good morning.
Thank you.